Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
What a nice afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams. Pete Zimmerman's the producer on the Wintrust Business Lunch. And Mondays, it's Elise Glink. Elise, Steve just gave us an uptick on the numbers for crypto, and I wanted to mention a column by Laura Washington in the Tribune. Do you got a minute?
Sure.
18% of black adults have bought or used cryptocurrencies. Almost one in five. 44% of crypto owners are people of color. 55% of crypto owners don't have a college degree. The median black family's wealth is $3,600, 2% of white families. Since May, more than $700 billion has been lost in the crypto crash. And so she writes, crypto is a peril for the black community. It's pushed by the likes of Jay-Z and Snoop Dogg and LeBron James. They are advocates for or investors in crypto. They're telling their followers this is the way to go. And while the profits have seemed alluring, so too have the losses been significant. And so she's making the point, and I hadn't thought about it in these terms. I didn't realize all of those demographic numbers, but crypto is a peril for the black community. Interesting story, huh?
It is, and it's sad because we already know that black families have about a tenth of the wealth that white families do, that they're much less likely to pass along what's known as generational wealth.
Right.
And I don't mean hundreds of millions of dollars, right? I mean simply, you know, maybe $100,000 or the equity in a home. Because, of course, black families are much less likely to be homeowners. One of the concerns around Robinhood, which is a trading platform that got very, very big, was that people were investing in it and not really understanding the ramifications of some of those investments. And there were stories, anecdotal, I don't have the same numbers that Laura Washington does, but it would be certainly interesting to see, of the people who are not making money on Robinhood, you know, what race they belong to, because I suspect there's a fair number of black people who are involved in that day trading that are simply not making money with it.
I felt that way about GameStop and all of those things, or any crypto for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, well, I don't know what's going on here, but it seems like people are getting rich, so I should do it too. And I felt foolish for not jumping in on Dogecoin or something after, you know, we heard about the very first ones. But I thought, I don't know how to do it. I'm intimidated by the whole process. So, you know, my lack of energy doesn't make me smart, but it did keep me out of that market. And maybe I could have made money. I don't know. It's a mystery.
I have not invested one dime yet in crypto. I have looked at it. I know a lot of people who have made millions, and I'm very happy for them. But the big money, I think, was made years ago, frankly. Before the pandemic, people were getting involved in some of these early stage, when they were earlier stage than they are now. But the problem with crypto internationally and is just that it is remains a place that gray market and black market people are dealing. It's a place where, you know, people are hiding wealth. You have the two guys who are running 3AC crypto platform. They've disappeared and there's a lot of money missing. So we're going to have to wait and see how this all plays out.
The other markets are up today, huh? The Dow is doing, I don't have the number in front of me now, but the markets have been up.
Yeah, it's very nice to actually have a day where everything's in the green. We don't get a lot of those right now, but the Dow up about a quarter of a point, 80 points around there. S&P is up half a point, and NASDAQ is actually up over 1%. I think we're waiting to see what the Federal Reserve is going to do. David Solomon, Goldman's CEO, came out this week and he said today actually and said that inflation is deeply entrenched in the global economy. We're watching central banks across the world raise their interest rates as much as 1% right off the bat. And so there's a lot of push right now that the Fed for the Fed to actually raise interest rates at least 0.75% from where it is today, and maybe even as high as 1%. I think there were a couple of Fed governors who said, "Yeah, we wouldn't be wouldn't be out of the park to say up 1%." The good news, if there is some good news in this, John, is that we do have to play this hand out, but the only reason the Fed wants to raise interest rates, I think, ultimately, is to have a method to be able to reduce them on the other side once we've gone through the recession to in order to restart the economy. That's, you know, it's not the only reason they're doing it, but it is a nice silver lining on the other side of this.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGM. I'm John Williams. Elise Glink, thinkglink.com is the website, and you hear her Sunday mornings on WGN with Tom Fortino. Talk just a little bit about real estate and who's snapping up some of these properties.
Sure. There was a new study that came out today from the National Association of Realtors that talked about a reversal in the annual amount of foreign investment in the U.S. existing home market. So these are not new homes that people are buying from other countries, but existing homes, and it climbed 8.5% over the last year to almost $60 billion. Now, for the last 3 years, that amount of investment had been going down, but in the last year, it actually reversed itself, and we saw that the number of existing homes that were bought actually declined to $98,000, fewest since 2009, but the price has gone way up.
International buyers buying billions of dollars worth of U.S. residential properties. So are these foreign nationals moving in, or are they just investing in it and you and I are buying these properties?
Well, both, actually. So we're seeing that the highest amount of money is coming from China, Canada, India, Mexico, and Brazil, which is really interesting. And the top U.S. destinations for these foreign buyers are Florida, Texas, Arizona, New York, and North Carolina. And so you never know for sure why people are doing it, but from Canada, most of these people are buying vacation homes, right, in sunny climes.
Yeah, right.
China, they typically are moving California, but also we're seeing a big influx into Texas and Arizona. Brazil, they tend to move to Florida, right? Some of the Mexico buyers do as well. So it's just interesting to see, you know, where people are going. But typically these are for secondary residences, sometimes primary residences.
Talk about credit cards and rising interest.
Yeah, so this is interesting. We're seeing that the amount of credit card debt that people are carrying is back to record levels. The amount is $841 billion just in the first 3 months of 2022, John. I mean, it's a huge number. We're well on our way to breaking all records this year. And obviously, rising interest rates are making carrying that debt much, much more expensive. But here's the thing. People aren't going off and buying, I mean, they are putting fabulous vacations, I guess, on their credit cards, but mostly what they're doing is gas, groceries, and other kinds of housing necessities. And it is, it's interesting to see people just trying to make it work, and they're not able to, and so they're putting it on their credit cards. This goes back to a report that we saw earlier this month, or maybe it was the end of June, and how much people are actually struggling now on a day-to-day basis. We're still in a good economy. People still have jobs. They're getting paid more for jobs, but they're really getting hit up on those daily expenses. And so we're seeing the number of people that are living paycheck to paycheck is almost at 60% right now.
Saw Hochberg, David Hochberg was loping through our hallways the other day. And by the way, that's how he locomotes. He lopes. And he said, you know, the credit card debt's over $1 trillion now, John, over $1 trillion. I thought that we had been paying down our credit cards. I thought we were doing a good job on that.
We were last year and the year before. The pandemic money, the cash that the government had been handing out, which, you know, causes other issues, but it was giving people a way to bank that dollar and pay down those debts. That's what people were doing. That has gone away, sadly, for a lot of people. And so we are seeing those numbers go up. Here's the concern that I have, John. You know, it's one thing for credit card debt to go up and, you know, gas prices are going to rise and fall, mostly rise. Food prices are up. But what happens when people have to start paying federal and private student loan debt again?
Well, I don't
that's going to be a real stretch.
Except that's never going to happen. I mean,
right?
Really,
how
long have we had forbearance on student loans? It's been since the beginning of the pandemic, right?
Yeah, we're almost at 2.5 years.
Can you believe that? 2.5 years. And some people, I don't know if anybody's actually for 2.5 years paid on the principal, and they may be, you know, really whacking away at that thing without having to pay interest. And I think the gamble, if you will, right, Elise, was that what if they issue for forgiveness and you didn't have to pay that off? So you might as well just keep the money in the bank. But when you have to start making payments again, and I'm of this week of mind that they're not going to give you $10,000 of forgiveness, now the interest will start to calculate again and you will have missed that opportunity to buy down the principal.
Yeah, it's really not a good situation. I mean, I thought at the beginning of the pandemic, it was an excellent opportunity for the government to say when interest rates were as low as they were, hey, anybody that wants to, we're going to refinance your student debt down to 1%. Right? And then if we end up, you know, forgiving it, great. But here it is, 1% forever. There are a lot of people who have interest rates on their debt of 6%, 7%, 8%.
Wait, this is the Elise Glink policy. That never happened, though, right?
It never happened, but I thought it would have been a great idea to do that. Government didn't do that. They just said, nobody's going to have any interest rate, and if you keep paying it down, great, it's like 0%. A lot of people did do that, but there is still $1.5 trillion that's outstanding, more or less, give or take. And it's a lot of cash. And I agree with you. I do not think we're going to see the government say, okay, nobody ever has to pay student loan debt again. Just don't see that happening.
There are some groups that have enjoyed forgiveness for a variety of reasons. But that big nut out there of just a bunch of people who went to the U of wherever and they're sitting on $25,000 of student debt or $200,000 of student debt, it looks right now like they're not going to wave the magic wand. And by the way, 10,000 was the number, right? I mean, it was never going to be 50,000, right?
I don't think so. The last number I heard was 10,000. I have not heard any kind of whispers from any corner that this is something they're really considering right now. And I think whatever happens, John, it's not going to happen until right before those first student loan debt payments are due again, which is in a couple of months. So yeah, the closer we get to the election, the more likely it is we're going to see something happen. Huh. I just don't think it's going to be for everybody.
What a coincidence. That's Elise Glink. Listen for her Sunday morning with Tom Fortino at 6:30 and click on thinkglink.com. Thanks, Elise.
You're welcome, John.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, WGN. Here's Austin Vance. He's the CEO of a software development firm and digital transformation consultancy. It's called Focused Labs. Austin, you're on WGN. How are you today?
Hey, John, I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm just learning a little bit about your business. You work with big businesses. We've heard about Hertz, Let Us Entertain You, Pods. What is it that you folks do?
Yeah, so we're a group of software consultants and product consultants that help large companies, you know, reach for innovation. So as enterprises build their kind of incumbency in market and have, you know, large customer bases, they tend to get slower and slower building legacy systems and older business process. And we come in and help replace old business process with new software so that they can stay ahead of disruptors.
Give me an example.
A good example is actually Hertz cars. So Hertz recently partnered with Lyft and Uber. You can rent a Hertz car right in your Uber or Lyft app. And so it required them to integrate and share information between, you know, modern San Francisco companies so that, you know, Uber or Lyft could understand the availability of Hertz's fleet. And so Focus Labs helped build the software and business process around that integration and that partnership.
Man, that sounds tough. That sounds complicated to me. You've got two, like you said, legacy companies, certainly Hertz. The rideshare companies are newer to the world, but I would imagine they've all got pretty entrenched software designs, plans, the way they do things. And now the one's going to integrate with the other, and you're the guy that's going to make that work, huh?
Yeah, we reach for the deep technical integrations, the hard stuff that makes, you know, big companies tick, whether it's, you know, payments infrastructure or autonomous vehicle, AI. That's really where we thrive.
Yeah. And then how do you find people that do that? Where are they from? What's recruiting like? How's your business going and growing?
Yeah, we started the company, we started the company 3.5 years ago, just before the pandemic, and got a little scared during the pandemic, but we've been tripling every year since we started. We were 100% Chicago until 2020, of course, and then now we're all over the United States, mostly focusing around the Chicago area and the central time zone, but all over the place. We have an internal recruiting team that's absolutely stellar. We focus a ton on culture, and we have a fairly modern approach to compensation. We adjust every employee's compensation monthly to match market, and that allows us to retain top talent as well as attract talent next to really popular, well-known, you know, tech companies like Google or Facebook.
Yeah. So then are these are they college graduates? Are they with IT degrees or software degrees? Who do you hire?
All over the place. We have people who have been in the industry for decades. We have people straight out of college. Everybody at Focus has a absolute passion for writing great software in a really high quality way. Working with clients, so we're very client facing and customer facing, unlike a lot of software services companies. We don't kind of disappear and build something for our customers. We integrate into their business process, work directly with their teams, and maybe even leave them with the skills that, you know, we have, so eventually our customers don't need us anymore. And we find them all over. I mean, young and old, experienced and not. And a lot of people who make the transition into software development as a career later in life also are wonderful employees.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea, because you think this is a kid's game. Are you talking about code writers, people that sit there and type up code?
Yep, 100%. People that sit there and write code. We also have design services, but yeah, we have a team of about 40 software developers. They 8 hours a day write code on a computer, video share with customers and push code to production.
Yeah. How many employees does your firm have now?
We're about 55 people now.
Focused Labs. Are you downtown? Where are you guys located?
We're in the old post office. So we moved in there 6 months ago.
Oh,
and
you
we
are,
absolutely love it.
You are the cool kid on the block.
It's a great building, and we have customers out there. That rooftop is to die for.
Yeah, no kidding. So how is it that you came into this 3.5 years ago, just before the pandemic? It would seem to me like somebody else would already be doing this in a big way, or that the Hertzes and the rideshare companies themselves would have people that do this. How did you find the niche?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I was working as a director of engineering at Braintree, which is a payments software firm in the merchandise mart owned by PayPal, and we were working with services companies similar to Focus Labs. And one of the problems I had with them is we would hire these services companies, and we absolutely loved the fact that they would bring external knowledge, a more modern approach to software, and a fresh perspective. But after a little while of working with them, we felt like we became beholden to them. So it was really hard to like take the knowledge from these other from these services companies and bring them back into, my company. And so I saw a niche, which was a delivery focus. We build products, services company that really, really focuses on modernizing the software workforce at big kind of enterprise companies. So instead of just delivering product like a kind of a commodity or software like a commodity, like offshore forms or a lot of other boutique software vendors, we work directly with our customers, educate them on new modern tech stacks, show them how to deliver software faster, and maybe even help companies hire great talent that competes with more modern kind of startup tech talent.
We have to wrap up this conversation, but I want to talk to you again. I just wonder if somebody like you loses sleep at night. So you launch the integration between two major companies. The next day it goes live. And by God, that had better work, Austin.
You do lose some sleep, I'll say that. But, you know, there's a lot of best practices to keep you from losing too much. That first night's always a little scary, though.
Austin Vance, CEO of software development firm and digital transformation consultancy company here in Chicago. How about that? Focused Labs. Nice to talk to you, Austin. Continued success.
Thank you, John. It was great to talk to you.
Likewise. 1244 on WGN. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. This is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Old Navy is closing its store on State Street. Cranes reports the retailer has decided not to renew its lease at State and Randolph. Brokers have already started marketing the 32,000-square-foot space to other retailers. It's a rare opportunity for another store to take over that space, described as a flagship opportunity. The store at 150 North State is across the street from Macy's. Old Navy is the latest to exit State Street. DSW closed its store at 35 North State back in June. It's unclear whether Old Navy plans to open a smaller store nearby or leave the neighborhood completely. OSF Healthcare, an Illinois-based Catholic hospital system, will only cover fertility treatments for its workers in opposite-sex marriages. The system operates 15 hospitals and 132 other facilities in Illinois and Michigan and employs more than 24,000 workers. Bloomberg reports the new policy could violate federal discrimination laws. The OSF policy is one of the first instances of an employer explicitly excluding workers from coverage because of their sexual orientation. I'm Steve Brzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Dow down about 0.1%. It's at 31,339. That's 51 points. S&P 500 down 0.2%, close to 9 points, 3872. The NASDAQ down, make that up about 0.5%, 53 points, 11,505.
Is that Lois Lane answering the phones in the background there?
I don't know who that was. I thought it was my phone, and it's not. Mine is on silent.
That was mine. I'm sorry.
I didn't even know what it was. I was like, what is that ring?
I didn't know telephones made that sound anymore.
Mine does, too, because you can pick that one, but I wasn't.
It's kind of charming in a way. Lois Lane here. What's that, Clark? All right, time for the business of food. Here's Steve Alexander.
Do you like burritos, John?
You.
Yeah, those big fat ones, the oversized ones, bulging at the seams. And then they leak, and they get all over the place. Yeah, there's a solution for that. We are sponsored, by the way, by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience live in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. One of the Emmy nominees last week was the actor who plays that goofy cousin Greg on Succession. In my opinion, probably the only likable character on the show. His name is Nicholas Braun. And he has also been acting in a commercial for a food delivery app where he appears to be eating scotch tape.
Now that you can get anything delivered with Uber Eats, can you eat anything you get delivered? I'd say probably. Oh, maybe not.
Turns out you can eat tape, thanks to the invention of Tasty Tape by four students at Johns Hopkins University.
Tasty Tape was created by a group of four undergraduate students, including myself.
Herself is Rachel Nee, a native of Gurnee, a graduate of Warren Township High School, and 2 months ago, Johns Hopkins.
I'm a chemical and biomolecular engineering major.
Inspired by their own experiences with one of life's messiest moments, when that big fat burrito is almost to your mouth and it starts to fall apart and the contents start leaking out.
No!
One of Rachel's lab partners, Aaron Walsh, said, well, how about edible tape to hold it together?
And then over the last year, we've kind of gone through tons of iterations until we found something that we were really happy with.
And after that big fat burrito is all rolled up, you put on a piece of Tasty Tape.
So that it doesn't fall apart when you're trying to eat it or cook it. And then we've expanded that to pretty much any type of wrap or bureau.
Yeah, the tape becomes part of the meal.
It is 100% edible. We have eaten so many of them. You can't feel it texturally. You can't taste it.
Next comes a patent. And after that,
you know, we would love to partner with a large company that wants to license it and go from there.
Wow, Rachel. Congratulations. This could be huge.
Thank you. Thank you. That is exactly what we're thinking.
There you go. Edible tape and Gurney's very own Rachel Nee. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Ken Benson joins us now, the president and CEO of an organization called SIFMA, S-I-F-M-A. Let's talk a little bit about that. Kenneth, you're on WGN. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you, John. Thank you for having me.
Tell me what you guys do. What's SIFMA?
So SIFMA stands for the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association. We're a trade association that represents investment banks, asset managers, and broker-dealers across the U.S. and the states. We have a number of outstanding members in the Chicagoland area, Loop Capital, Northern Trust, William Blair, Mesereau, Citadel, just to name a few. Yeah. We have members all over the country who comprise the vast majority of the U.S. Capital markets.
With a new administration comes new rules, and the SEC has got more regulations for businesses to abide by. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this is an interesting phenomenon that's going on. We have a very aggressive Securities and Exchange Commission. The securities industry in the U.S. is highly regulated, and the SEC is our primary regulator. The new administration has suggested that they're going to propose 54 new rules, and in fact, they've already proposed 27 that hit across all aspects of the markets. We're not necessarily opposed to everything, but we are concerned in some instances about the process of trying to do too much too fast and not prioritizing, and in another instance about actually making some bad decisions. You had the really interesting story about Tasty Tape listening in. It just shows what a great country this is, that through our academic institutions, the students can come up with this idea. And as your reporter talked about, they're eager to grow that company, find partners, and in many cases they would find private equity partners and then ultimately take that company public, really following the American dream. But in fact, some of the rules that are being proposed by the SEC today would make it harder for private funds to invest in a company like Tasty Tape, might make it harder for a company like Tasty Tape to go public, say, through a SPAC. And we think that the SEC really needs to sit back and think about the rules it's proposing, how they interact with one another, what the negative knock-on effect could be on the market, and then think about prioritization of what really needs to be done now in terms of risk mitigation. What are things, where is the need for doing this?
Well, that's it, risk mitigation. I mean, I presume at the end of the day, the idea is to protect me, the consumer, or that young up-and-coming business. What's the vulnerability here? What needs to be done?
Well, the vulnerability could be a company like Tasty Tape might not have access to investors that it could otherwise have if you change the rules. You're absolutely right. I mean, at the end of the day, we need to have a fair, equitable, and transparent market, which we do in the U.S. We have the best markets in the world in the U.S., and as I said, they're highly regulated. But if you don't get the regulation right, or if you have conflicting regulation, you actually could end up affecting you, the retail investor, either in reduced returns or increased risk. And so this is where we're saying to the commission, to the SEC, you really need to prioritize here. You really need to make sure you're hearing from stakeholders. And they really haven't been doing that because they've been rushing the process. And really, they're doing it also absent a clear congressional mandate. So our strong suggestion is to step back. Make sure you're getting all the information you can get in. Make sure you're doing sufficient cost-benefit analysis. Make sure you understand how one rule you propose interacts with another rule you propose, and whether or not the policy you're proposing actually makes sense at the end of the day for the retail investor or the company like, Tasty Tape, let's say, in the future, that ultimately wants to go public.
These are new regulations that the SEC is proposing and promoting. Ken Benson is the president and CEO at SIFMA. That's all the time I have today, Ken. I know we're going to talk to you down the road. We'll continue to follow this. Thanks for helping us get started today.
Thank you, John. It's an honor to be on your show.